Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me in a bit will be... Well, wait, who's on the show this week? Tim Phillips, there we go. I really kind of spaced there for a minute. Anyway, yes, Tim Phillips is going to be joining us for this week's review. On this windy day as I'm recording here, so if you hear the slight rattle of the window pane, it is because of the wind here at End Credits headquarters, which is also Politico headquarters, which is also my house. So that's life. And we're still living it in these pandemic days. End Credits is a local movie show for our local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new musical biopic drama Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which you can now stream on Netflix. Now, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is based on a real-life blues singer, a woman named Ma Rainey, who is called the Mother of the Blues. So it's a very black story. Black as in race, not black as in... It's a dark story, although there is darkness. But it's, you know, it's a black story, it's black history, it's got a black cast, it's a black director. And just by coincidence, it is the start of Black Heritage Month. It used to be called Black History Month, and it's still called Black History Month in some quarters. But before the holidays, the Guelph Black Heritage Society announced that they will be marking Black Heritage Month instead of Black History Month as a way to promote black history just beyond slavery and escaping from slavery and the end of slavery, which is unfortunately what we tend to think about when we think about Black History Month. So, since it is Black Heritage Month, we've been encouraged here at CFRU as programmers to try and integrate that into the programming in some way. And, I mean, the review this week, I said, is black director, black history, black cast. It is, I think, fulfilling the requirement, but I'm going to take it a step further by spending this first part of the show talking about great movies by black directors. And I'm going to try and avoid some of the obvious picks. Not in terms of the directors, I think you'll recognize a lot of these directors, but I mean in terms of the movies I'm going to highlight. So I'm going to start with an unusual pick. Number one I have here is Tim Story, who is predominantly known for these kind of awful Hollywood movies he's made. He made the first two Fantastic Four movies. He made Taxi, which is this horrible Jimmy Fallon movie. He made the Shaft reboot remake a couple of years ago. Anyway, Tim Story, his first big film was actually a small comedy called Barbershop, which starred Ice Cube. And it is a great little slice of, you know, ensemble comedy, a lot of great actors in it, including Keith David, Anthony Anderson, Ice Cube, who I mentioned. It's this tight little story about community and you know, trying to struggle to find your place, and the Ice Cube character inherited the family barbershop and is unsure if he wants to keep it up and is looking to move on, but ends up coming to realize the importance of the barbershop to the identity of the neighborhood as a sort of a gathering place. And it's kind of a cute little story. And also inspired, like, a big kind of barbershop franchise. There have been numerous sequels and spin-offs, too. You can find that on video on demand, wherever you rent your movies, on digital platforms. The next one I want to highlight is from Mario Van Peebles, who is predominantly known as a actor, but he has also done a lot of directing. He's done a lot of TV directing, but he's also made several movies, too. By far, his most accomplished one is this movie, Badass, which is a semi-autobiographical movie about him, but also mostly about his father. And it's this weird kind of thing where Mario Van Peebles plays his father, Melvin Van Peebles. And it's about Melvin Van Peebles making his signature movie, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which, you know, Melvin Van Peebles is sort of like carved out a name for himself, but he was, of course, like a lot of directors, interested in sort of creative control. So he kind of refused to go into the Hollywood system in order to retain the creative control he wanted. And Mario Van Peebles playing his father, which again is kind of a, that's got to weigh on you pretty heavily. But he looks at his father quite earnestly and quite honestly, looking at his father in his career and his father's own internal psychology with warts and all. So that couldn't have been very easy, but it is a very accomplished movie, and Mario Van Peebles is great in it too. So you can find that on Apple TV. I want to highlight the first two movies of the Hughes brothers, Albert and Alan Hughes. Their first two films were Menace to Society and Dead Presidents. And they're these movies about people who kind of follow this path of self-destruction. In Menace to Society, the two main characters are trying to, you know, basically trying to make it day to day, and just through their sort of unwillingness to try and seek out better circumstances for themselves, end up destroying themselves. And in Dead Presidents, it's the opposite. It's like the ambition ends up ruining the main characters. It's really kind of two fascinating different studies, of sort of the struggles and in modern black culture, in the United States, and in urban black youth, I should say. Also, I want to point out Dead Presidents has an amazing action set piece, one of the best, you know, shootouts in sort of modern film. It is worth the price of admission alone. And so you can find both those Hughes Brothers movies on VOD. I'm going to highlight three here from this next filmmaker, F. Gary Gray. He's kind of been, you know, in and out of the Hollywood grinder through his career. But he made Friday, which is like one of those rare kind of like generational comedies that, you know, you have to see. It's like, you know, like Animal House or Ghostbusters. Friday is definitely like that. If you want to kind of get to the root of like stoner culture, stoner humor, Friday is essential viewing. He also made Set It Off, which is basically like the Steve McQueen movie Widows, but made like 20 years beforehand, and perhaps even more compelling in certain ways, because it's not as flashy as Widows. It's not as well polished as Widows, shall we say. It's got its edge. And then, of course, in 2015, he made Straight Out of Compton, which is the biopic about NWA, and if it had been about a white music group, like a biopic about a white music group, like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or something, it would have won all the Oscars. And it definitely deserved to be more recognized than it did. And the fact that it wasn't is one of the things that kicked off the Oscars So White campaign a couple of years ago. It was just the fact that it was kind of completely blocked out of participation at the Oscars. Next on my list I have... Oh, all those movies you can find on VOD, by the way. Next on my list, I have Ryan Coogler, and Ryan Coogler's very well known for the two big blockbusters he made, for the first Creed movie, and Black Panther, of course. But I want to highlight his first film, Fruitvale Station, which was based on the real life of Oscar Grant, who was killed in Oakland in a police shooting while he was in police custody. That is dramatized very, very effectively, very, very scarily, I guess. So it makes it very, very timely indeed. The focus of the film is on Oscar Grant's last days. Great performance by Michael B. Jordan, his breakthrough. I mean, this is like Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler breaking through together. And still haunting. Even years after seeing it, it came out in 2013. And you can find Fruitvale Station on Stars if you have that streaming app, or you can find it on the Cineplex site. Next, I have Ava DuVernay, who, of course, a lot of people remember for her biopic Selma, which is about Martin Luther King Jr. and the march on Selma, Alabama, in 65. The follow-up film she made was A Wrinkle in Time, which is an adaptation of a children's book. It doesn't get nearly enough credit for just not necessarily fitting the Disney mold, and even though it's sort of made in this era of where Disney's sort of franchising everything, and everything feels like CG blah, and everything's being franchised and set up for sequels and spinoffs and all that stuff, Wrinkle in Time kind of slides in. It's just this perfectly wondrous little artifact where it's not about the spectacle, it is about the motion behind it and the emotion. And really beautifully directed, beautifully acted too, when you get Reese Witherspoon or Oprah Winfrey in there. And the kids are a highlight. It's a really gently directed film. And the kind of spectacle, because there is spectacle in it, but it's not cheaply done, is what I want to say. I think Ava DuVernay really kind of brings a lot of grace to that spectacle in A Wrinkle in Time, and I think it's definitely worth a revisit. And you can revisit it if you have Disney Plus. Barry Jenkins is my next person I want to highlight here. His two big movies, Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk, they're like kind of vastly different movies, but they both have this kind of lyrical, dreamlike quality to them. They're kind of like romantic, kind of fairy tale vibey, even though they both deal with deeply serious social issues. In the case of Moonlight, it's like the three different time periods for a gay black man and his struggles relating to his father, relating to his sexuality, finding a romantic partner. And then If Beale Street Could Talk is about these two lovers who are basically torn apart by a system, a criminal justice system that, you know, automatically assumes guilt if you are black and male, and how they navigate that and how they are able to reconnect and stay connected and come back together through all the hardships. It's a really beautiful film that I still think about a lot, even though I saw it for the first time a couple of years ago. That's worth coming back to as well. So you can find Moonlight on VOD, but If Beale Street Could Talk is on Amazon, though I think it's migrating to Netflix soon. But it's easy enough to find. Any discussion about black directors, you can't have it without these two gentlemen. One is John Singleton, who was the first black man to get an Oscar nomination for Best Director. That was for Boys in the Hood. I'd like his follow-up even better, Poetic Justice, because there is still a lot of, again, the effect of urban crime on black people who live in those areas, how they try to get out, try to avoid meeting these like ghastly fates that these socioeconomic circumstances sort of forced on them. And Poetic Justice is about these like two gentle souls who have been through that and end up trying to find a way to connect to each other. And that is easier said than done. You have two really great performances from two people who are predominantly known as musicians, so Janet Jackson and Tupac Shakur. And it is just beautiful. Like, the ending is so beautiful. It doesn't necessarily wrap everything up into a neat little bow, but there is tremendous hope at the end, which is a rare message when you think about the Boys in the Hood or Menace to Society and these similar movies and that were about black communities in this time period that end kind of melancholy or end kind of tragically. There is hope at the end of Poetic Justice, which I really enjoy. And then, of course, Spike Lee, who is probably the most accomplished, most successful black filmmaker. I mean, he has almost near creative freedom, which is a really, really rare for black filmmakers. I mean, what can you say? Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X, He Got Game, The 25th Hour, Inside Man, which is maybe one of the best police movies to come out in the last 20 years, one of the best crime movies, like just straight up popcorn crime movies, Inside Man. And then what he won the Oscar for, finally, The BlacKkKlansman. So all of those movies are great. You could pick them out and watch any one of them. I mean, Spike Lee has not always let's say dunked the ball when it comes to some of his films, but I mean there are a lot of really great standouts that you can enjoy. And both the films of John Singleton and Spike Lee are actually pretty easy to find on VOD. Many of John Singleton's movies, because they're released through Sony, you can find on the CTV website, and their local streamers. A lot of Spike Lee's movies you can find on Stars and VOD, and of course BlacKkKlansman you can watch on Netflix easily enough. Maybe to wrap it up, I want to highlight another black female director, Kaisi Lemons. She made the Harriet Tubman biopic a couple of years ago that is unfortunately her most highest rated film because it's not an exceptionally great film. Her great film, though, is Eve's Bayou, which is this kind of gothic NOLA set film in the 1960s about this prominent black family in New Orleans. And it's got a bit of mysticism, it's got a lot of melodrama and self-doubt and reckoning for this little black girl in New Orleans who has a lot of doubts about the kind of man her father is and a lot of secrets, and it's really, really compelling. And of course I'll highlight Jordan Peele too, because I mean he's a new kind of really prominent black voice in American filmmaking, because you get Get Out, you get Us, and Us is definitely worth a revisit because there's just so much there. And then of course he's got stuff coming out, like, well, he was a producer of Lovecraft Country. That's tough to say, even though I've typed it a million times. But I think the Lovecraft Country is a very rewarding experience. At least when I was watching it week to week, I didn't binge it. I watched it every episode every week. And then I would also highlight too that he's the producer of the Candyman remake that is coming out sometime, hopefully sometime this year. And there's been a lot of great buzz from that. Speaking of great buzz, we will review Ma Rainey's Black Bottom coming up after the musical break. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community
Your
Radio.
Black bottom is really good. Come on and show me your black bottom. I wanna learn that dance. I wanna see the dance there. Call the black bottom. I wanna learn that dance. Wanna see you do the dance you call your big black bottom. It puts you in a trance. Early one morning, about break of day, Grandpa told Grandma, I heard him say, get on up and show your old man your black. I wanna learn that dance, yes sir. I wanna learn that dance.
They don't care nothing about me. All they want is my voice. Well, I done learned that. And they're gonna treat me the way I wanna be treated, no matter how much you hurt them. birthday back there right now, calling me all kinds of names, calling me everything but a child of God. But they can't do nothing else because they ain't got what they wanted yet. Soon as they get my voice down on one of them recording machines, then it's just like I be some whore and they roll over and put their pants on. They ain't got no use for me then. I know what I'm talking about. You watch. And Irvin, he right there with the rest of them. He don't care nothing about me either. He been my manager for 6 years, and the only time he had me over his house was to sing for some of his white friends.
Huh, I know how they do.
Yeah, shit, you colored and you can make them some money, then you all right with them. Otherwise, you just a dog in the alley.
And that was a clip from Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. It is the new film from George C. Wolfe, and it stars Viola Davis, Chadwick Boseman, Glenn Turman, Coleman Domingo, Michael Potts, and Jeremy Shamos. So we're now being joined on the line by Tim Phillips. Tim, how are you today?
Doing well. How are you doing, Adam?
Not too shabby, all things considered. It's 2021, and that used to mean hope. Now we're not so sure. Anyway.
2022. I'm betting on 2022.
Here's the 2022.
I'm preparing for my New Year's celebration for 2022 already.
That sounds perfectly reasonable, all things considered. I mean, there is some reason to be hopeful. And before we get into this movie review, which is Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, I just wanted to point out that since this episode's airing on February 3rd, it is officially Black Heritage Month. And this is the third movie in a row that we've reviewed on the show that features a predominantly Black cast from a Black director. And that's not too shabby, because we know how hard it is for directors of color and movies that feature people of color to get attention. And it's been we've completed the unofficial hat trick of If Not Now When, One Night in Miami, which was last week's review, and then this week Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
That's great. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that, but yeah, it's yeah, it's good to see more directors from, you know, ethnically diverse directors, casts, and you're seeing that a lot more now, a lot more female directors too, and it's pretty amazing how things have changed in the last few years, you know, because like previously, I think like 93% of directors were male, and I don't know how many of those were white male, and so it's really... really good to see, like, yeah, see these changes, and it just adds variety and just, you know, it's not the same old sort of rehashes and remakes and stuff that we were seeing, and there seems to be a lot more opportunity now, especially since everyone's streaming films, for there to be a wider range of voices and people checking out stuff they might not normally have when they just went, you know, to the big summer blockbuster movies and stuff like that.
Well, this is it. I mean, we joke about the pandemic and being in lockdown, but the fact that, you know, movie theaters aren't open and you get all these big movies delayed, because if you make a movie that is built to make $1 billion, you can't do that without the movie theaters being open. So what gets all the attention? These movies that are made for lower budgets that can be bought by streamers for profit, and that is typically these small budget films, because studios don't really invest in, you know, smaller stories, more complex stories, more diverse stories anymore. And those are the films that are getting seen. And I think if there is sort of a positive to the movie industry due to the pandemic, it's that it's kind of accelerated those changes you're talking about.
For sure. And I, you know, it's just easier now to watch diverse films and even films from different countries. Now I'm probably watching more foreign films than I would have previously. So it's, yeah, it's really, it is one of the pluses from this situation we're in, but I think it is good that people are kind of expanding what they're watching, which, you know, I found it maybe troubling a few years ago when it was just like all the same, you know, same types of movies over and over again, you know, because I like, I often like more of the smaller films and, you know, often realistic or artistic films. So this is good. It's good to see.
Tim's not sitting at home going, why don't they just release Black Widow on Disney Plus and get it over with?
I'm not that type of, that's a big segment, but I'm not, that's not my, it's not what's keeping me up at night. You know?
Fair enough. Yeah. So let's get into Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which I also want to make the other note. It is Chadwick Boseman's final film. Mm-hmm. And that's too bad because, I mean, between this and The Five Bloods, he was having an awesome year until he died of cancer in August. So let's just start with your immediate feelings, Tim. What drew you to Ma Rainey's Black Bottom?
Yeah, I selected it just seeing that it had really, really strong reviews. I knew very little going in about it. I knew it was Chadwick Boseman's last film, and I knew it was based, I'm not sure, loosely or based on a blues singer from the 1920s named Ma Rainey. So that I found that appealing. And then when I started watching the film, it was about 20 minutes in, and I'm like, this has to be based on a play. Like, it's so theatrical. I'm like, and it's like only like one or two settings. I'm like, this is based on a play. So I just paused it. And then I saw it was based on an August Wilson play from his Pittsburgh cycle, and it's the second one that's been adapted. Fences, unfortunately, I haven't seen. So after seeing this, I think I'll check it out and stream Fences. But yeah, I was attracted by, you know, something musical by the cast, Viola Davis and Chadwick Boseman, and that's what kind of drew me in. And then I was like, wow, yeah, this, I think this is based on a play. And then it was cool, like, just because it really let the actors really flourish in the film. So I thought the performances were really strong, and I really appreciated watching that and seeing them be able to develop their characters, you know, maybe without all the bells and whistles. My one criticism might be, you know, it does feel like you're watching a play. I could use maybe a few more cinematic flourishes, but all in all, I thought really strong performances, and I really enjoyed the film.
Yeah, I was kind of vaguely aware it was based on a play because I think I picked up that piece of information somewhere. But I mean, I said this last week to Peter in a review of One Night in Miami, because that's also based on a play. And there's a scene in it where the four main characters enter the hotel room, and there's a definite feeling that this is kind of where the play begins. Yeah. It's like they have entered the stage.
Yeah.
And I did have that feeling too watching Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, because when the band shows up at the studio and they're shown into the practice space, I'm like, oh yes, here's where the play begins, because until then you get these montages and these scenes of Ma Rainey and the band performing. And from what I understand about the play, what I've read about the play since watching the movie, is that the play does actually begin with the band entering the practice space. And it's one of those things, the play is, where it's called Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, but you're waiting for, you know, 20, 30 minutes for the title character to actually show up. So that's a little piece where the movie deviates from Ma Rainey. It does open with Ma Rainey versus the play, which does not open with Ma Rainey. But yeah, I have a lot of same feelings. The acting in it is so strong, and there are moments where you can feel like this is a play. Mm-hmm. Because it's all about the monologues and the performances. But the director, George Wolfe, there are certain scenes in it where he kind of does where he's kind of filming the dialogue like it's an, or editing the dialogue, I mean, like it's an action scene where it's these quick cuts and the actors are kind of speeding up the dialogue a little.
you know, it just feels there's kind of this action, I guess, kind of action movie feel to it, even though they're just talking. But the way it's edited, the way it's shot with these like kind of weird Dutch angles at times, and there's the one monologue where Levy, the Chadwick Boseman character, is talking about how the violent attack on his family when he was a kid, and I think I said this about something. There was a scene in One Night in Miami. I said like it would have been interesting if they had actually like showed it, the scene, instead of having the character explain the scene. And I was thinking about that as Levy was explaining what happened to his family. I'm like, you know what? I don't even need that, because I can sort of feel the intensity, and I can feel the psychological effect it's had on him. Like it's not just a matter of hearing the story. It's like, I feel put off by this, just the way that George Wolfe is shooting it. So there are scenes where he's able to elevate the dialogue and make it a bit more cinematic, which I kind of enjoyed. But you're right, it is, I mean, you can, there is definitely a feeling of, hey, we filmed a play. And that can kind of draw your attention at times. But I mean, at the same time, I'm not sure I can call it a critique or a demerit, because there are other scenes where George Wolfe really likes to get in there and like use the camera to convey emotion as much as watching the actors, which of course is tremendous too. Like the acting is just wicked.
Yeah. And I think George Wolfe, the director, I did some research afterwards, and he's a theater director too. So kind of makes sense that he was comfortable, you know, with those scenes with the longer monologues. And he has done some film directing, but he's mainly, his experience in the past is theater. But that served him well, like you were saying. And there are some really powerful moments, like when Chadwick Boseman is talking about the trauma he had as a child, and his mother was raped, and he's talking about it, and you can really feel his pain. And I think there was some good camera movement with that, for sure. And when he takes when he's with Ma Rainey's lady friend, Ma Rainey's girlfriend, in that other room, and they're having like a sexual encounter. There's a lot of good, you know, camera movement, cutting to people hearing it, that guy trying to read his book and stuff while it's going on.
Yeah,
there's a really good moments like that. And I think it works well. Yeah, that would be like sort of like a minor criticism for me, would be, you know, how it feels like a play. But you know, so many, you know, like go back, watch like Glengarry Glen Ross or something, you know, that's I found that powerful at the time that I saw it back in the 90s, and it was like, you know, that's a play too. You could feel, you know, this is how it would be on stage. And it's sort of a minor criticism, but overall really powerful. I think Chadwick Boseman, you know, unfortunately this was his last film, but he definitely went out on a high note, and I think there would be a lot of posthumous acclaim for his role. And it's very powerful, and Viola Davis very good as well. And when it started out, I thought it was gonna, because it starts out with her singing, because you're wearing like the title, you know, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, you know, what does this mean, you know? And it does start out because she has a sort of like vaudeville background with like raunchy comedy background. And when it starts out, I was feeling like, okay, is this going to be raunchy, like Dolomite Is My Name or something? You know, you know, she's talking, singing a song about, you know, sex and stuff, and everyone's hooting and hollering in that opening scene. And then it does expand from there, and it becomes something a lot more serious and a lot more, you know, a lot more focus on race, definitely, with, you know, the band is all black. She's the star. She calls all the shots. And yet she has this manager who's white, who keeps trying to persuade her to do different things, to change up her music, to not include, she wants to include her nephew who has a bad stutter to do an intro to one of the songs that during the recording. And he says, well, that's going to, you know, waste time. We can't do that. And she just puts her foot down, like she's totally in control of mm-hmm. the situation. So it's interesting to see that from that era to the 20s, how much power the star had to call the shots and how she knew, like, there's a really good, I think, monologue by her where she's talking about, mm-hmm. you know, it seems like I have all this power, but, you know, this manager's never even invited me over to his house for dinner or anything. And I've been with him for 6 years. So, you know, there's this background of, you know, Pittsburgh in the 20s and what the race relations were and, you know, the discrimination. So juxtaposed with how much power she has in that setting, in that recording where she calls the shots. So it's interesting to see that difference and just, you know, see how she has so much power in one realm. And then in the other realms, there's so much discrimination, right?
Yeah, I found that very interesting because it's set up in such a way. I mean, if you're not familiar with, you know, the music and the blues in the 1920s, you know, you may think that she's kind of being full tilt diva and, you know, she's not going to start until she's had her Coke and you know, insisting her nephew does this opening sort of intro and all these other demands. And you're kind of forgiven, like, oh, she's such a diva. And, like, maybe that's kind of the gist we're kind of get at. It's like, these are the good old days where, you know, even a black woman who would be, you know, the subject of sexism and racism in, you know, 1927, you know, here in this environment, she can, you know, throw her weight around. And it's not about ego at all. She kind of reveals in this monologue to the what is Cutler? Is he the piano? No, he's not the piano player. Toledo's the piano. Whatever Cutler does, but he's kind of the leader of
trombone the band. Player.
Yeah. But he's kind of the leader of the band, basically. And she says, you know, all they want is my voice, and I'm going to, and you know, all they want is my voice. They will, you know, just kind of usher me out when they've got the recording. That's all they want from me. So I am going to make them fight for this thing they want because, you know, I'm a black person. I'm a commodity. The commodity they want is my voice. They are going to have to jump through every hoop I put in front of them in order yeah. to get it. And you're like, ah, I like it. It's a form of like social protest. It's like, she's using the tools she has to buck the system, buck racism, buck the white man. And you know, you can really see in this, the manager's, Irving is his name. He's kind of like, kind of, you know, he comes off as very affable and he's like, comes off as very warm and welcoming to like, hey, it's the band. We're going to get you guys some sandwiches. And it's like, on the other hand, you can sort of see where the pleasantries of that veneer, you can see where it kind of peels off because he's just trying to get through the day too. It's he's not really friends with these people. You do get that sense despite the pleasantries that Ma Rainey has his number too. And there's yeah. just this great scene when Irving tries to shoot back at her some of her demands, and Viola Davis just like stares him down with daggers in her eyes, and he just like, okay, no, don't worry, Ma, I'll take care of it. And it's just, it is so brilliant, it is so funny, and Viola is God in this, and it is so wonderful to watch.
Yeah, and when you talk about sort of the race relations aspect, the ending, I won't give it away, it's really, really jarring ending, and then right at the very end, you're seeing this all white band play, you know, and play so stiffly, play this blues song mm-hmm. so stiffly. And it definitely, it's a comment at the very end about, you know, how the business worked. Like you're saying, it's business. And Viola Davis, that great monologue, she realizes that, she, as Ma Rainey, she's, you know, I realize they just want my voice. You know, once they got, they have everything, it's all released, it's, you know, they put it out, the record, they're just going to want me again for another record. That's it. You know, they won't care about what happens to me tomorrow or anything like that. You know, it's just, yeah, it's pretty powerful. And yeah, the ending I found very sort of jarring and powerful as well.
The ending, again, without giving anything away, as you said, it's I don't know if it was, if it's part of the play or not. I can't imagine it is. I think it is an invention for the film, but it has a very Twilight Zone feel.
Yeah,
where it's like after this struggle to get this like 4-piece blues band, you know, to produce this record the way the artist wants it to produce. And then you're right, you see these like, and it's like 20 guys in this band, 20 yeah. white guys, and they're all stiff and they're all so preppy and they're all so snappy, and it's just it feels so mechanized in a sense. And it seems like there was just something very Twilight Zone about it, it was kind of genius on George Wolf's part.
Yeah, it's all these white guys stiff, all wearing like the, you know, it's we'd be back whatever in the 20s or 30s, you know, wearing the white shirts and the,
and the silver suits and
silver suits and just playing like not even playing very well, like just I don't know, it's like high school band grown up or something. That's just all, yeah, and that's yeah, and it does come across like, ooh, this is. Yeah, it definitely has a Twilight Zone feel at the end, which is a bit different from, you know, from the play that we see before that, right? Which is very powerful, real, you know, real, all kinds of verbal abuse being slung, physical abuse, all kinds of stuff happening. And then all of a sudden you got this, you know, wacko Twilight Zone sort of ending. But it does fit with it, definitely, especially for the message they're putting forth, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to highlight, too, the script. It is based on the August Wilson play, but it was written by Ruben Santiago Hudson, who is one of these actors who turns up in various things. You know, he was in... he was in John Singleton's Shaft remake. He was in Selma. I think he was in American Gangster too. He's done a ton of TV. Like he was on Castle and The West Wing. And so, I mean, if there's a kind of feeling that this is an actor's showcase, it's because there was an actor who was also behind the screenplay too. But I mean, also because he's done such extensive work on the screen, I think that's probably why. I guess the sharp edges that make you realize that this is a play are kind of rounded off. It's still kind of a play to an extent, but there's, like I said, there's a bit more urgency to some of the scenes. There's a bit more punch, and I'm sure that's the screenwriter's touch, Ruben Santiago Hudson, who's bringing his experience as a theater director and a playwright, as well as his experience as an actor on the big and small screens.
Yeah, definitely. Having never seen the play, I don't know how much of the dialogue was invented for the film or taken from the play, but it all seems to all works together really well, and it's makes for a really powerful piece, especially when you sort of see things accelerating psychologically, especially for the Chadwick Boseman character. And it really, you can see, you know, you can see his sort of pride versus desperation, you know, sort of like false vanity, and you can sort of see what the character is going through. And definitely the screenwriter in concert with that performance, which is a great, excellent performance, really, really makes it very powerful.
I think there's going to be a thing in the years to come where people are going to be like, did Chadwick Boseman know this was going to be his last movie? Because there's definitely a feeling of just he's leaving nothing behind. Like, he's just you know, he hits every note. He, like every bit of anger is so sharp. Every bit of regret is just there on his face. And I don't know how much of it is sort of direction or how much of it is him kind of understanding his own mortality. Because, I mean, again, because of the way the movie ends, you know, there's a, let's just say there's a definitive end for Levy at the end. I can't help but feeling that Chadwick Boseman's own mortality was, he was using that in making the film. And I don't know that for absolute certainty, and maybe I'm reading into that knowing that after the production was finished on this film, he got so sick that he had, from cancer, he ended up passing away. But it's going to be one of those things. It's going to be one of those sort of Hollywood legend things. I mean, mark my words, in like 3 years, you're going to see the thing in the IMDb trivia. It's like, oh, Chadwick Boseman knew he was dying while making this movie, so he was determined to make it his best performance. There's going to be something like that. But I mean, it's justified, and that was something I was definitely feeling watching the film. It's like, Maybe he knew this was it, and he was leaving it all on the field, and he was exiting and saying, like, this is going to be the one I'm going to be remembered for. And I don't know, maybe he's right.
Could have been, like, he could have definitely been using that, and the role really fits that sort of, you know, like you're saying, regret, desperation. It fits with all that. So I was kind of thinking that myself. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he was kind of using that. That was really helping with his motivation for the character. And because he did know about his illness for a while, right? He just didn't publicize it. So
yeah, he's been sick for years. Yeah.
Yeah. So that definitely could have been a factor. And just the casting, the fact that he had this role, you know, definitely makes it seem like, yeah, that he could use that for motivation. He definitely was in a good place with this role to use anything he had in his past, or any past regrets, anything he felt as a, you know, a black man in America, anything he felt, you know, like we're saying, regret, desperation. He definitely, that could have been fuel for the fire. I imagine it was. Mm-hmm. And same for Viola Davis's character, being, you know, because she's in a unique place, right? Being a, you know, a movie star, right? And this Ma Rainey was like a star of the blues scene, but still having to deal with racism, sexism, which still persistent today. Mm-hmm. Different times in the 20s, but I'm definitely, I think all these actors could have used their experiences for how they related to the characters.
And yeah, like Viola, because this past week, Cicely Tyson passed away, and Cicely Tyson sort of famously uncompromising in her own idealism as an artist, to not take on parts that she thought would reflect badly on black women. And I think Viola Davis is sort of molded in that tradition. I mean, not coincidentally, they're also on How to Get Away with Murder together. That was good. I guess good casting fate there. But I think Viola Davis definitely is drawing on her own experiences too. You know, being a black woman in the Hollywood machine. I mean, she's an Oscar winner, and she more or less gets to write her own check. But I mean, that is not an easy place for a black woman to get to, unless perhaps your name is Halle Berry. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely a feeling that at least those two actors in particular are drawing over, drawing some very deep, very real life stuff and bringing it to the screen. And I think that just adds to the authenticity of the film too, which again, you know, based on a real life figure, Ma Rainey, one of these sort of legends. She's called the Queen of the Blues, and I admit to only knowing about her in passing, just from you know, general interest about the 1920s, you know, jazz movement. But I mean, this I'm not sure this is based on a particular. This is like that. Michael Ondaatje book coming through Slaughter, where it's like, mm-hmm. it's based on a real figure. There was research done. Ondaatje pulled like whatever he could about this jazz figure he's writing mm-hmm. a book about, but a lot of it too is about filling in blanks and using a real life figure to tell a story that means more than just sort of the facts and narratives of their own life. And I think that this is another instance of that there's the story about Ma Rainey in the play is something that's a bit bigger than Ma Rainey's life and can sort of fit the mold for not just any black artist, but any era. And I think this is another one of those films that kind of wasn't designed to suit the moment, but because there's something sort of timeless about it, it's one of those films that fits the moment. Like One Week, One Night in Miami and a lot of these other films that went into production before last summer and the revitalized Black Lives Matter movement, which in retrospect, give voice to an unprecedented time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like so much has changed and so much hasn't, right? And that's probably that'll be a constant theme. And we were talking before about Denzel Washington. He was saying mm-hmm. that he has an association acting in August Wilson plays, and he wants to help produce the remaining eight, or at least some of them, from the Pittsburgh cycle, get those out. So mm-hmm. be interesting to see as more and more of those are released, you know, what we think of those, because they're all from different decades, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, what have you, 90s. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, fashions change, but how much has racism really changed, right? And
mm-hmm.
Everywhere, but in this case, you know, U.S. and specific to Pittsburgh. And one thing I noticed in this film, I didn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of introduction of Pittsburgh or anything, but mm-hmm. I know it is from his Pittsburgh cycle. So be interesting to know more about the neighborhoods and stuff like that. I don't know if the other ones touch on that a little bit more. This was, you know, based in the recording studio. There was a little bit outside with a cop, a police officer, you know, and Ma Rainey had, I don't know. We don't see it, but the police officer says that like she hit him and she's like, well, like he deserved it kind of thing.
So, yeah. It's, I loved, because that was another one of those moments where, you know, she's kind of staring him down and the guy backs off, even though he's a guy, you know, it's just the sheer force of personality of Ma Rainey is undeniable. And yeah, to attach to what you were saying, like Denzel Washington was a producer. He produced and directed the adaptation of Fences, which these are meant to be the first two in a string of August Wilson adaptations, all 10 of his plays. I don't know what one might be coming next, but I picked it up somewhere that he already had in mind which one he was going to adapt, and I think what's his name? Who wrote 12 Years a Slave? I can't remember.
Who wrote it or directed it? Was it the same person? McQueen?
No. Steve McQueen directed it, but it was somebody else who wrote it. And I'm just going to try and look it up really fast, even though my podcast desk here is a mess with notes and things. And I have to type on a thing with one finger. There we go.
Oh.
12 Years a Slave was written by John Ridley. So I think that's who Denzel has lined up to direct the next one. So that should be interesting because John Ridley is a talented and multifaceted filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And he can probably do some stuff with the August Wilson material, because certainly you can do a lot with a little. And I think Ma Rainey's Black Bottom proves that in spades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely I'd recommend it, and it's streaming now on Netflix, so it's available mm-hmm. for anybody who wants to see it who has Netflix. So
mm-hmm. And Fences might be there too, so you can make it a back-to-back kind of movie night deal.
Yeah.
All righty, Tim, if people want to talk more about August Wilson or anything with you, where can people find you on the internet?
Flash in the Deadpan on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Not TikTok yet.
Only Peter is so bold so far, but we will...
Haven't made the step to TikTok.
Well, few are as bold as Peter, so...
That's true.
And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And speaking of Spotify, you can find at least most of the music that we play on the End Credits Show over the years. You can find that in a single playlist at Spotify. Just search for End Credits on CFRU in your Spotify app. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can see my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. Or you can read my writing about horror movies at the Nightmare on Film Street site, which you can find at nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Keeping Your Meters is up next, and we will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more End Credits, and we will see you then.